Normally, we would welcome people to the reading. And what are we reading? Cantos 2 and 3 of book 4. And a short meditation.
Book 4, the Book of Birth and Quest, Canto 2, the Growth of the Flame. A land of mountains and wide sunbeat plains and giant rivers pacing to vast seas, a field of creation and spiritual hush, silence swallowing life's acts into the deeps, of thought's transcendent climb and heavenward leap, a brooding world of reverie and trance, filled with the mightiest works of God and man, where nature seemed a dream of the divine, and beauty and grace and grandeur had their home, harbored the childhood of the incarnate flame. Over her watched millennial influences, and the deep godheads of a grandiose past looked on her and saw the future's godheads come, as if this magnet drew their powers unseen. Earth's brooding wisdom spoke to her still breast, mounting from mind's last peaks to mate with God's, making Earth's brilliant thoughts a springing board to dive into the cosmic vastnesses. The knowledge of the thinker and the seer saw the unseen and thought the unthinkable, opened the enormous doors of the unknown, rent man's horizons into infinity. The shoreless sweep was lent to the mortal acts, and art and beauty sprang from the human depths. Nature and soul vied in nobility. Ethics, the human keyed to imitate heaven. The harmony of a rich culture's tones refined the sense and magnified its reach to hear the unheard and glimpse the invisible, and taught the soul to soar beyond things known, inspiring life to greaten and break its bounds, aspiring to the immortal's unseen world.
Leaving Earth's safety, daring wings of mind bore her above the trodden fields of thought, crossing the mystic seas of the beyond to live on eagle heights near to the sun. There wisdom sits on her eternal throne. All her life's turns led her to symbol doors, admitting to secret powers that were her kin. Adept of truth, initiate of bliss, a mystic acolyte trained in nature's school, aware of the marvel of created things, she laid the secrecies of her heart's deep muse upon the altar of the wonderful. Her hours were a ritual in a timeless fane. Her acts became gestures of sacrifice. Invested with the rhythm of higher spheres, the word was used as a hieratic means for the release of the imprisoned spirit into communion with its comrade gods. Or it helped to beat out new expressive forms of that which labors in the heart of life, some immemorial soul in men and things. Seeker of the unknown and the unborn, carrying a light from the ineffable to rend the veil of the last mysteries. Intense philosophies pointed earth to heaven, or on foundations broad as cosmic space, upraised the earth mind to superhuman heights. Overpassing lines that please the outward eyes, but hide the sight of that which lives within, sculpture and painting, concentrated sense upon an inner vision's motionless verge, revealed a figure of the invisible, unveiled all nature's meaning in a form, or caught into a body, the divine.
The architecture of the infinite discovered here, its inward musing shapes captured into wide breaths of soaring stone. Music brought down celestial yearnings. Song held the merged heart absorbed in rapture's depths, linking the human with the cosmic cry. The world interpreting movements of the dance molded idea and mood to a rhythmic sway and posture. Crafts, minute in subtle lines, and eternized a swift moment's memory, or showed in a carving sweep, cup's design, the underlying patterns of the unseen. Poems in largeness cast like moving worlds, and meters surging with the ocean's voice, translated by grandeurs locked in nature's heart, but thrown now into a crowded glory of speech, the beauty and sublimity of her forms, the passion of her moments and her moods. Lifting the human word nearer to the gods. Man's eyes could look into the inner realms. His scrutiny discovered numbers law and organized the motions of the stars, mapped out the visible fashioning of the world, questioned the process of his thoughts, or made a theorized diagram of mind and life. These things she took in as her nature's food, but these alone could not fill could fill not her wide self, a human seeking, limited by its gains. To her they seemed the great and early steps, hazardous, of a young discovering spirit which saw not yet by its own native light. It tapped the universe with testing knocks, or stretched to find truth mind's divining rod. There was a growing out to numberless sides, but not the widest seeing of the soul, not yet the vast, direct, immediate touch, nor yet the art and wisdom of the gods.
A boundless knowledge, greater than man's thought. A happiness too high for heart and sense, locked in the world and yearning for release, she felt in her. Waiting as yet for form, it asked for objects around which to grow, and a nature's strong to bear without recoil the splendor of her native royalty. Her greatness and her sweetness and her bliss, her might to possess and her vast power to love. Earth made a stepping stone to conquer heaven. The soul saw beyond heaven's limiting boundaries, met a great light from the unknowable, and dreamed of a transcendent action's sphere. Aware of the universal self in all, she turned to living hearts and human forms, her soul's reflections, complements, counterparts. The close outlying portions of her being, divided from her by walls of body and mind, yet to her spirit bound by ties divine. Overcoming invisible hedge and masked defense, and the loneliness that separates soul from soul. She wished to make all one immense embrace, that she might house in it all living things, raised into a splendid point of seeing light, out of division's dense inconscient cleft, and make them one with God and world and her. Only a few responded to her call. Still fewer felt the screened divinity and strove to mate its godhead with their own, approaching with some kinship to her heights. Uplifted towards luminous secrecies, or conscious of some splendor hidden above, they leaped to find her in a moment's flash, glimpsing a light in a celestial vast, but could not keep the vision and the power, and fell back to life's dull, ordinary tone.
A mind daring heavenly experiment, growing towards some largeness they felt near, testing the unknown's bound with eager touch, they still were prisoned by their human grain. They could not keep up with her tireless step, too small and eager for her large-paced will, too narrow to look with the unborn infinite's gaze, their nature weary grew of things too great. For even the close partners of her thoughts, who could have walked the nearest to her ray, worshipped the power and light they felt in her, but could not match the measure of her soul. A friend, and yet too great, holy to know, she walked in their front towards a greater light, their leader and queen over their hearts and souls, one close to their bosoms, yet divine and far. Admiring and amazed, they saw her stride, attempting with a godlike rush and leap heights for their human stature too remote, or with a slow, great, many-sided toil, pushing towards aims they hardly could conceive. Yet forced to be the satellites of her sun, they moved, unable to forego her light. Desiring, they clutched at her with outstretched hands, or followed stumbling in the path she made. Or longing with their self of life and flesh, they clung to her for heart's nourishment and support. The rest they could not see in visible light. Vaguely they bore her inner mightiness. Or bound by the senses and the longing heart, adoring with a turbid human love, they could not grasp the mighty spirit she was, or change by closeness to be even as she. Some felt her with their souls and thrilled with her, a greatness felt near, yet beyond mind's grasp. To see her was a summons to adore. To be near her drew a high communion's force.
So men worship a God too great to know, too high, too vast to wear a limiting shape. They felt a presence, they feel a presence and obey a might, adore a love whose rapture invades their breasts. To a divine ardor quickening the heartbeats, a law they follow greatening heart and life. Open to the breath is a new diviner air. Opened to man is a freer, happier world. He sees high steps climbing to self and light. Her divine parts, the soul's allegiance called. It saw, it felt, it knew the deity. Her will was puissant on their nature's acts. Her heart's inexhaustible sweetness lured their hearts. A being they loved whose bounds exceeded theirs. Her measure they could not reach, but bore her touch. Answering with the flower's answer to the sun, they gave themselves to her and asked no more. One greater than themselves, too wide for their ken, their minds could not understand nor wholly know. Their lives replied to hers, moved at her words. They felt a Godhead and obeyed a call, answered to her lead and did her work in the world. Their lives, their natures moved, compelled by hers, as if the truth of their own larger selves put on an aspect of divinity to exalt them to a pitch beyond their earths. They felt a larger future meet their walk. She held their hands. She chose for them their paths. They were moved by her towards great unknown things. Faith drew them and the joy to feel themselves hers. They lived in her. They saw the world with her eyes. Some turned to her against their nature's bent, divided between wonder and revolt, drawn by her charm and mastered by her will, possessed by her striving to possess. Impatient subjects, their tied, longing hearts hugging the bonds close of which they most complained, murmured at a yoke they would have wept to lose, the splendid yoke of her beauty and her love. Others pursued her with life's blind desires, and claiming all of her as their lonely own, hastened to engross her sweetness meant for all.
As earth claims light for its lone separate need, demanding her for their sole jealous clasp, they asked from her movements bounded like their own and to their smallness craved a like response. Or they repined that she surpassed their grip, and hoped to bind her close with longing's cords. Or finding her touch desire too strong to bear, they blamed her for a tyranny they loved, shrank into themselves as from too bright a sun, yet hankered for the splendor they refused. Angrily enamored of her sweet, passionate ray, the weakness of their earth they could hardly bear. They longed, but cried out at the touch desired, inapt to meet divinity so close, intolerant of a force they could not house. Some, drawn unwillingly by her divine sway, endured it like a sweet but alien spell. Unable to mount to levels too sublime, they yearned to draw her down to their own earth. A force to center round her their passionate lives, they hoped to bind to their hearts' human needs, her glory and grace that had enslaved their souls. But mid this world, these hearts that answered her call, none could stand up her equal and her mate. In vain she stooped to equal them with her heights, too pure that air was for small souls to breathe. These comrade selves to raise to her own wide breaths, her heart desired and filled with her own power, that a diviner force might enter life and breathe a Godhead greaten human time.
Although she leaned down to their littleness, covering their lives with her strong, passionate hands, and knew by sympathy their needs and wants, and dived in the shallow wave depths of their lives, and met and shared their heartbeats of grief and joy, and bent to heal their sorrow and their pride, lavishing the might that was hers on her lone peak, to lift to it their aspirations' cry. And though she drew their souls into her vast, and surrounded with the silence of her deeps, and held as the great mother holds her own, only her earthly surface bore their charge and mixed its fire with their mortality. Her greater self lived, soul unclaimed within. Oftener in dumb nature's stir and peace, a nearness she could feel serenely won. The force in her drew earth's subhuman broods, and to her spirit's large and free delight, she joined the ardent-hued, magnificent lives of animal and bird and flower and tree. They answered to her with the simple heart. In man a dim disturbing somewhat lives. It knows but turns away from divine light, preferring the dark ignorance of the fall. Among the many who came drawn to her, nowhere she found her partner of high tasks, the comrade of her soul, her other self, who was made with her, like God and nature, one. Some near approached, were touched, caught fire, then failed. Too great was her demand, too pure her force. Thus lighting earth around her like a sun, yet in her inmost sky, an orb aloof, a distance severed her from those most close, puissant, apart her soul as the gods live.
as yet unlinked with the broad human scene, in a small circle of young, eager hearts, her being's early school and closed domain, apprentice in the business of earth life, she schooled her heavenly strain to bear its touch, content in her little garden of the gods, as blooms a flower in an unvisited place. Earth nursed, unconscious still, the inhabiting flame, yet something deeply stirred and dimly new. There was a movement and a passionate call, a rainbow dream, a hope of golden change. Some secret wing of expectation beat, a growing sense of something new and rare and beautiful stole across the heart of time. Then a faint whisper of her touched the soil, breathed like a hidden need the soul divines. The eye of the great world discovered her, and wonder lifted up its bardic voice. A key to a light still kept in being's cave, the sun word of an ancient mystery sense, her name ran murmuring on the lips of men, exalted and sweet like an inspired verse, struck from the epic lyre of rumor's winds, or sung like a chanted thought by the poet Fame. But like a sacred symbol was that cult, admired, unsought, intangible to the grasp, her beauty and flaming strength were seen afar, like lightning playing with the fallen day, a glory unapproachably divine. No equal heart came close to join her heart. No transient earthy love assailed her calm. No hero passion had the strength to seize. No eyes demanded her replying eyes. A power within her awed the imperfect flesh. The self-protecting genius in our clay divined the goddess in the woman's shape and drew back from a touch beyond its kind, the earth nature bound in sense life's narrow make.
The hearts of men are amorous of clay kin, and bear not spirits lone and high who bring fire intimations from the deathless plains, too vast for souls not born to mate with heaven. Whoever is too great must lonely live. Adored, he walks in mighty solitude. Vain is his labor to create his kind. His only comrade is the strength within. Thus was it for a while with Savitri. All worshipped marvelingly, none dared to claim. Her mind sat high, pouring its golden beams. Her heart was a crowded temple of delight. A single lamp lit in perfection's house, a bright, pure image in a priestless shrine. Midst those circling lives, her spirit dwelt, apart in herself until her hour of fate. End of Canto 2.
So do you want to pause just for reflection at this point?
Well, the next canto is not too long, and then we could open it up after the two.
Okay.
I think I understand what's going on here, so so why don't we continue?
Okay. Canto 3, The Call to the Quest. A morn that seemed a new creation's front, bringing a greater sunlight, happier skies, came burdened with a beauty moved and strange out of the changeless origin of things. An ancient longing struck again new roots. The air drank deep of unfulfilled desire. The high trees trembled with a wandering wind, like souls that quiver at the approach of joy, and in a bosom of green secrecy, forever of its one love note untired, a lyric coil cried among the leaves. Away from the terrestrial murmur, turned where transient calls and answers mix their flood, King Ashwapati listened through the ray to other sounds that meet the sense-formed ear. On a subtle interspace, which rings our life, unlocked were the inner spirit's trance-closed doors. The inaudible strain in nature could be caught across this cyclic tramp of eager lives, across the deep urgency of present cares. Earth's wordless hymn to the ineffable arose from the silent heart of the cosmic void. He heard the voice repressed of unborn powers murmuring behind the luminous bars of time. Again, the mighty yearning raised its flame that asks a perfect life on earth for men and prays for certainty in the uncertain mind and shadowless bliss for suffering human hearts and truth embodied in an ignorant world and Godhead divinizing mortal forms.
A word that leaped from some far sky of thought, admitted by the cowled receiving scribe, traversed the echoing passages of his brain and left its stamp on the recording cells. O force compelled, fate driven, earth born race, O petty adventurers in an infinite world and prisoners of a dwarf humanity, how long will you tread the circling tracks of mind around your little self and petty things? But not for a changeless littleness were you meant, not for vain repetition were you built. Out of the immortal's substance you were made. Your actions can be swift, revealing steps, your life a changeful mold for growing gods. A seer, a strong creator is within. The immaculate grandeur broods upon your days. Almighty powers are shut in nature's cells. A greater destiny waits you in your front. This transient earthly being, if he wills, can fit his acts to a transcendent scheme. He who now stares at the world with ignorant eyes, hardly from the inconscience night aroused, that look at images and not at truth, can fill those orbs with an immortal's sight. Yet shall the Godhead grow within your hearts. You shall awake into the spirit's air and feel the breaking walls of mortal mind and hear the message which left life's heart dumb and look through nature with sun-gazing lids and blow your conch shells at the eternal's gate. Authors of earth's high change, to you it is given to cross the dangerous spaces of the soul and touch the mighty mother stark awake and meet the omnipotent in this house of flesh and make of life the million-bodied one. The earth you tread is a border screened from heaven. The life you lead conceals the light you are.
Immortal powers sweep flaming past your doors. Far off upon your tops, the god chant sounds, while to exceed yourselves, thought's trumpets call. Heard by a few, but fewer dare aspire, the nympholepts of the ecstasy and the blaze. An epic of hope and failure breaks Earth's heart. Her force and will exceed her form and fate. A goddess in a net of transience caught, self-bound in the pastures of death, she dreams of life. Self-wrecked with the pains of hell, aspires to joy, and builds to hope her altars of despair. Knows that one high step might enfranchise all, and suffering looks for greatness in her sons. But dim in human hearts the ascending fire, the invisible grandeur sits unworshipped there. Man sees the highest in a limiting form, or looks upon a person, hears a name. He turns for little gains to ignorant powers, or kindles his altar lights to a demon face. He loves the ignorance fathering his pain. A spell is laid upon his glorious strengths. He has lost the inner voice that led his thoughts, and masking the oracular tripod seat, a specious idol fills the marble shrine. The great illusion wraps him in its veils. The soul's deep intimations come in vain. In vain is the unending line of seers. The sages ponder in unsubstantial light. The poets lend their voice to outward dreams. A homeless fire inspires the prophet's tongues. Heaven's flaming lights descend and back return. The luminous eye approaches and retires. Eternity speaks, none understands its word. Fate is unwilling and the abyss denies. The inconscient's mindless waters block all done.
Only a little lifted is mind's screen. The wise who know see but one half of truth. The strong climb hardly to a low peaked height. The hearts that yearn are given 1 hour to love. His tale half told falters the secret bard. The gods are still too few in mortal forms. The voice withdrew into its hidden skies. But like a shining answer from the gods, approach through sun-bright spaces, Savitri. Advancing amid tall heaven-pillaring trees, apparelled in her flickering colored robe, she seemed burning towards the eternal realms, a bright moved torch of incense and of flame that from the sky-roofed temple soil of earth, a pilgrim hand lifts in an invisible shrine. There came the gift of a revealing hour. He saw through depths that reinterpret all, limited not now by the dull body's eyes, new found through an arch of clear discovery, this intimation of the world's delight. This wonder of the divine artist's make, carved like a nectar cup for thirsty gods. This breathing scripture of the eternal's joy. This net of sweetness woven of aureate fire. Transformed, the delicate image face became a deeper nature's self-revealing sign, a gold leaf palimpsest of sacred births, a grave world symbol chiseled out of life. Her brow, a copy of clear, unstained heavens, was meditation's pedestal and defense, the very room and smile of musing space, its brooding line, infinity's symbol curve. Amid her tresses, cloudy multitude, her long eyes shadowed as by wings of night under that moon-gold forehead's dreaming breadth, were seas of love and thought that held the world. Marveling at life and earth, they saw truths far.
A deathless meaning filled her mortal limbs, as in a golden vase's poignant line, they seemed to carry the rhythmic sob of bliss, of earth's mute adoration towards heaven, released in beauty's cry of living form towards the perfection of eternal things. Transparent grown, the ephemeral living dress bared the expressive deity to his view. Escaped from surface sight and mortal sense, the seizing harmony of its shapes became the strange, significant icon of a power renewing its inscrutable descent into a human figure of its works that stood out in life's bold, abrupt relief on the soil of the evolving universe, a godhead sculptured on a wall of thought, mirrored in the flowing hours and dimly shrined in matter as in a cathedral cave. Annulled were the transient values of the mind. The body's sense renounced its earthly look. Immortal met immortal in their gaze. Awakened from the close spell of daily use that hides soul truth with the outward form's disguise, he saw through the familiar cherished limbs the great and unknowing spirit born his child. An impromptu from the deeper sight within, thoughts rose in him that knew not their own scope. Then, to those large and brooding depths whence love regarded him across the straits of mind, he spoke in sentences from the unseen heights, for the hidden prompters of our speech sometimes can use the formulas of a moment's mood to weigh unconscious lips with words from fate. A casual passing phrase can change our life.
O Spirit, traveler of eternity, who camest from the immortal spaces here, armed for the splendid hazard of thy life, to set thy conquering foot on chance and time, the moon shut in her haloed dreams like thee. A mighty presence still defends thy frame. Perhaps the heavens guard thee for some great soul. Thy fate, thy work are kept somewhere afar. Thy spirit came not down a star alone. O living inscription of the beauty of love, misalled in aureate virginity, what message of heavenly strength and bliss in thee is written with the eternal's sun-white script? One shall discover and greaten with it his life, to whom thou loosenest thy heart's jeweled strings. O rubies of silence, lips from which there stole low laughter, music of tranquility, star lustrous eyes awake in sweet large night, and limbs like fine linked poems made of gold, stanzaed to glimmering curves by artist gods, depart where love and destiny call your charm. venture through the deep world to find thy mate. For somewhere on the longing breast of earth, thy unknown lover waits for thee, the unknown. Thy soul has strength and needs no other guide than one who burns within thy bosom's powers. There shall draw near to meet thy approaching steps, the second self for whom thy nature asks. He who shall walk until thy body's end, a close-bound traveler, pacing with thy pace. The lyrist of thy soul's most intimate chords, who shall give voice to what in thee is mute. Then shall you grow like vibrant kindred harps, one in the beats of difference and delight, responsive in divine and equal strains, discovering new notes of the eternal theme.
One force shall be your mover and your guide. One light shall be around you and within. Hand in strong hand, confront heaven's question, life. Challenge the ordeal of the immense disguise. Ascend from nature to divinity's heights. Face the high gods, crowned with felicity. Then meet a greater God, thyself beyond time. This word was seed of all the things to be. A hand from some greatness opened her heart's locked doors and showed the work for which her strength was born. As when the mantra sinks in yoga's ear, its message enters, stirring the blind brain, and keeps in the dim ignorant cells its sound. The hearer understands a form of words, and musing on the index thought it holds, he strives to read it with a laboring mind, but finds bright hints, not the embodied truth. Then, falling silent in himself to know, he meets the deeper listening of his soul. The word repeats itself in rhythmic strains. Thought, vision, feeling, sense, the body's self are seized unutterably, and he endures an ecstasy and an immortal change. He feels a wideness and becomes a power. All knowledge rushes on him like a sea. Transmuted by the white spiritual ray, he walks in naked heavens of joy and calm, sees the God face, and hears transcendent speech. An equal greatness in her life was sown. Accustomed scenes were now an ended play. Moving in muse amid familiar powers, touched by new magnitudes and fiery signs, she turned to vastnesses not yet her own. Allured, her heart throbbed to unknown sweetnesses. The secrets of an unseen world were close. The morn went up into a smiling sky, cast from its sapphire pinnacle of trance. Day sank into the burning gold of eve. The moon floated, a luminous waif through heaven, and sank below the oblivious edge of dream. Night lit the watchfires of eternity. Then all went back into mind's secret gaze. A darkness stooping on the heaven bird's wings sealed in her senses from external sight and opened the stupendous depths of sleep. When the pale dawn slipped through night's shadowy guard, vainly the newborn light desired her face. The palace woke to its own emptiness. the sovereign of its daily joys, was far. Her moonbeam feet tinged not the loosened floors. The beauty and divinity were gone. Delight had fled to search the spacious world. End of Canto 3.
That's such an interesting last line for the canto, I find. Carries us right into the next canto, isn't it?
Yep, she's on her way.
So there's a moment here in this last canto when King Ashwapati is invoked and Savitri is his daughter. And is he the one speaking these latter words? Because there's a voice that comes in. There are two sections that include, that are in quotes and where there are voices. Or is it, and also there's a sense that there's something spoken almost despite oneself or coming through oneself. So are these words that Ashwapati speaks to Savitri, even though he's not totally the one, the source of them, they're coming through him, but where he's, as it were, prophesizing that there's another out there for her, there's an equal, you know, to her spiritual greatness, and that if she goes forth, she'll find him. I think that that's what's going on, but I want to make sure.
My feeling is that it is now Ashwapati, the father, speaking to his daughter, because he has recognized her. Mm-hmm. He's seeing the truth of her and tells her to go find her match, her mate. That's my sense. What do you think, John Robert?
Yeah, I agree. The first voice is a voice inside of Ashwapati that's talking to Ashwapati. And so it's an inner voice he hears, and it wakes him up so that he can look at Savitri with new eyes, because, you know, it's been the family scene, everything familiar and so on. And then the second voice is Ashwapati speaking to Savitri, like Andrea said.
I love that line in 373 where the father and daughter are looking at each other and it says immortal met immortal in their gaze.
Right after that, right below that, near the bottom of the page, Sri Aurobindo says, he spoke in sentences from the unseen heights. And then he talks about what speech can do in certain times. For the hidden prompters of our speech sometimes can use the formulas of a moment's mood to weigh unconscious lips with words from fate. A casual passing phrase can change our life. And then Ashwapati utters that phrase that changes everything.
Is there a particular phrase that comes in this next dialogue or this next speech? That was the part I was responding to in my first comment. So you can use the formulas of a moment's mood to weigh unconscious lips with words from fate. So the formulas of a moment's mood seems like what's available in language in the relationship between maybe father and daughter. where they're seeing beyond or through their relative relationship with each other as father and daughter, and seeing the divine, seeing the God in each. And he's speaking from there, through there, but through his role, as it were, as father to daughter. But it doesn't seem casual. That's what threw me off a little bit, because there's a great great poetry in this language.
Yeah. And
it's fairly lofty. So I'm curious about that part of the text.
I take that line, a casual passing phrase can change our life, to mean to be a universal. It's like Sri Aurobindo is all of a sudden he's looking at us and saying, this can happen, you know, be awake, this can happen. And then he goes back to the story, and he activates Ashwapati's voice, and I agree with you, it's not casual at all, it's majestic.
Yeah. So it's actually the hidden prompters of our speech sometimes can use the formulas of a moment's mood, and the hidden prompters, it's like reading the Vedas, you get this feeling that the gods are directing the show. And so that the hidden prompters of our speech can sometimes, you know, transcend our little mind into something pouring through. I'm sure all of us have had that experience, that all of a sudden we find ourselves speaking some kind of wisdom that wasn't ours. Yeah.
It's also interesting what people remember, because I've had the experience a few times where people say I've said something that has stuck with them, but it's not something I particularly put a lot of importance on when I said it. It just was something that happened to come out of my mouth. And for them, it was especially meaningful. And I've had that too, I imagine, like with others, where the little things they say that are not the main topic of their speech stick with me and are meaningful to me and shift my orientation, my understanding of things. And so I wonder perhaps if this speech is meant to, in other words, like through the indirect hearing of something, that we are awakened into the same way or to the same quest, like that the savitri aspect of our being is awakened through this just overhearing, as it were.
I think you're just describing that a casual passing phrase can change our life. May not even know that we said it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because other forces are working through us and behind us, you know, or however you want to say that. We're not in control. Stuff happens.
That's the truth.
Sometimes when these inspirations come through, and one voices them, and someone asks you later, you know, well, what did you say? It's like, I don't know. It came through kind of on its own.
So, yeah, it's like, so I was looking at this word nympholepsy, which is a word that escaped me the last time we read this. But I looked it up. So nympholepsy is related to nympholepsy, which is a condition of being possessed by a nymph-like ecstasy, right? So yeah. So here we have immortal powers sweep flaming past your doors. So that sounds like what Andrea just told us. Far off upon your tops, the god chant sounds, while to exceed yourself, thoughts trumpets call. Heard by a few, but fewer dare aspire, the nympholepsy of the ecstasy and the blaze. So we're all nympholepsy, maybe, in these in these readings.
Where are the nympholepsy? I don't find the piece.
Top of page 371.
Ah.
So we're in the inner voice of Ashwapati, but you know, I think it's Ashwapati talking to Ashwapati to get awakened, but it's also our own inner voices talking to us in a way, right? So
yeah. Exactly. That's why he wrote it down, right? So we yeah. could read.
I wonder if there is a connection between the personal stories of Aurobindo and Mother and this almost the like how nobody else is good enough, right, for them. Like they needed to find each other to meet their counterpart to themselves, to their deepest selves. And was there some pre-Aurobindian phase of the mother's life where she was seeking or she was being sought but or being unmet? Did she have like students or suitors or friends or something that
she had husbands? Oh. the mother had two husbands.
Okay.
So my feeling is actually we were reading that part today. This is so exactly describing Mother's experience in her life before she found Sri Aurobindo. It doesn't really resonate for me with Savitri, who's this innocent young woman growing up in the palace. It feels to me like a real description of Mother's life before she came to Sri Aurobindo. With all the people she connected with, many people. She was in the midst of culture. You know, she had a salon where people came to talk about spiritual stuff and the new world and things like that. And I think the way he describes how people were attracted to her, and then, of course, nobody could actually measure up to her, could actually meet her greatness and bear her force. She had to hold back herself until she met Sri Aurobindo, and then there was no holding back.
So the aspect of Savitri that is reflected in Mother's life or vice versa is like really the soul aspect, which even though she's a woman contemporary with friends and associates and is part of participating in culture, and I think in the earlier canto there's, you know, almost her encounter with the, you know, the classics, the Greeks, the you know, classical aesthetics and knowledge and so forth, but there's this soul aspect of her which is still young, is still the child Savitri, and still has not yet ventured forth from her home, as it were, from the, you know, the protective sphere of the father's home. So there's like that archetypal like overlay, you know, with the actual.
Right. The whole poem is called a symbol for a reason, for that very reason. It symbolizes their lives. Yeah. It symbolizes Mother's and Sri Aurobindo's journey and consciousness. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So with Savitri, you have, she's very young, and her mother, when she came to Sri Aurobindo, she was in her 40s. So, you know, she had already quite a full life as an adult, you know, with two marriages and a child and traveling, you know, living in Japan.
Mm. She had already met Sri Aurobindo in her inner life before she met him in the body. And she had no real knowledge of India or Indians. But she called him the visionary, the person that she met in some of her visions. She called him Krishna. And then when she met him, she describes how perfectly he was even standing in a certain way. And when she saw him, and it was just like Krishna of her dreams. And then, I mean, to take it one step further, Krishna and Sri Aurobindo were really closely associated during Sri Aurobindo's physical life. In fact, there was an experience that Sri Aurobindo had of Krishna coming into him. And I mean, so there was an identification that happened that that Sri Aurobindo recognized and Mother recognized too, and is even celebrated as a, you know, by the integral yoga community as the agreement by Krishna coming into Sri Aurobindo, of the agreement of the overmind world, the agreement of the gods world, you know, the world of the gods, to the transformation.
It sounds like Pentecostal, but maybe not that, you know, when the Holy Spirit coming and filling the apostles. Like,
I don't know if it's like that or not. I'd be hard pressed to say whether it was like that or not. It was obviously it was a really big change in Sri Aurobindo's life and his yoga. At that point, he realized that he needed to withdraw from the outer life. I mean, he was meeting people and there was lots of activity, and he needed to go in and really focus on this yoga that he had been called to.
That's different, actually, then. I mean, the Pentecost was the apostles of Jesus being filled with the Spirit to go forth and spread the good news, like to right. spread the gospel. So this is actually almost the opposite of that. It's more of the inner, like focusing, the inner honing of the sense before, like, one might even, you know, try to communicate it to others. And that's just my...
I don't know. I mean, you could look at it, and if you wanted to compare them, you could look at it and say that the coming of Krishna was a big impetus for Sri Aurobindo to really hone in on his work. And you could say he was going out. I mean, he was going out. He just wasn't going out to this level. He was going out looking for, I mean, he may have been, this may have been, I don't know, the time after he retired when he was traveling, doing the Traveler of the Worlds, going through the worlds. I don't know if that's true or not, though. I mean, that's pure speculation. Yeah, he may have been doing that when he was writing the Record of Yoga, which was much before that time.
So you're saying the traveling may have been, traveling part of this text may have been written after the story, it's the savatry story itself.
No, I'm saying that, and again, this is just pure speculation. I have no idea whether it's true or not. But once Sri Aurobindo retired, it was in 1926 or 1928 or something like that. And Mother, he had Mother take over the ashram. And he retired. And what he did was, in his room, he paced 8 hours a day. And he was in trance. And he was doing this work. And I'm just speculating that the Traveler of the Worlds that we just read in Savitri, you know, where he travels from realm to realm to realm to realm, looking for this something that he didn't know. I mean, Ashwapadi didn't know what it was. He just knew that he needed to find something. And it may, that all these different worlds that Ashwapadi discovers and lives in and works through, Sri Aurobindo did that. And if he did that during that time or after Krishna came or not, I don't really know.
So, of course, for this use of this storyline, he fits it into the storyline in Savitri. So we don't know when he had the, I mean, he writes only from his own experience. This is not coming from his mind. He's not writing a story. He's writing down, he's transcribing his experiences. And he has put them in the form of the story of Savitri. So how these things chronologically match in Mother and Shorbindo, that we don't know. But it's all in here.
But the correspondence would be, or Shorbindo would be more Satyavan, right, than Ashwapati. So Ashwapati is father to Savitri, and he's almost the prehistory of their meeting, right? He's like the context within which they arise to, to meet this profound need or this profound aspiration, which he discovers through those travels.
I think Sri Aurobindo himself actually describes Satyavan as the human soul.
Okay.
Yeah. And of course, their relationship is all in it. There is unavoidable. I mean, when he describes her, when they're in love and all of that, that is his experience in the physical realm, right, in his life. But as a symbol, I think their Satyavan is us.
And the author's note at the beginning of Savitri, beginning mm-hmm. of the book, is what Andrea is talking about. And he says, Satyavan, this is the symbol part, Satyavan is the soul carrying the divine truth of being within itself, but descended into the grip of death and ignorance. So that's Satyavan's role in the story, his descent. There's lots of symbolism around that, or his father and his father's loss of Satyavan's father's loss of his kingdom and being exiled and out in the woods. And it's not a simple one-to-one match. It's a lot more varied and complex than that. So Satyavan is the one for whom Savitri was made to do the work together. So in that sense, you could say that's similar to Sri Aurobindo and Mother. But the work that they do is really different from, the work that Savitri and Satyavan do together in the rest of the epic that we're just starting, the second half of the epic that we're just starting now, is different in character than the work that Sri Aurobindo and Mother did together.
It's interesting. I've seen now that it's not a mistake, but it's limiting to try to establish direct correspondence. Obviously, a lot is drawn from the relationship, but there's also a different story being told. Mm-hmm. And being enacted too, because if Satyavan is the human soul, then that's us. That's all the readers of this poem, and beyond. Also, anyone presumably touched by the work of that Sri Aurobindo and the Mother initiated and promoted in the world. This is like their future. Like this is. Like the future of their work itself, rather than a story about their lives, and although clearly much is drawn from that romance, if you will, or that meeting in human terms, so I think that that helps me actually understand this a bit better, because I also think that we're here reading this, so. Really, we're not reading about something else. We are reading about a story, and we're thinking about and discussing Sri Aurobindo and the Mother and how this came about and what they've taught and the transmission that is carried through, particularly through the text, but also through your direct contact with them. But then the act of reading is putting ourselves into the story, because, right, and then we can participate in the journey, right? We can become travelers, and we can participate in the love story of the soul and the ultimate, right? So that's
really... he wrote it intended it to be a transmission.
Mm-hmm.
We are on the receiving end of this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he wrote it, because this is beyond all his other writings. This is the direct, immediate mantric transmission for us to receive and bring it into our own life, however we can, or however she directs us.
So Andrea and I, along with Matthew and some others, have been reading from The Secret of the Veda, which is the book, or one of the books, that Aurobindo wrote about the Vedas. And it's become increasingly clear as I delve into that book that I don't know how much of Aurobindo's ideas and what he writes about in his various writings all seem to be grounded back into the Vedas. If you read the Vedas, and especially Aurobindo's interpretation, his commentaries on the Vedas, you see all the rest of his thought right there in the text of the Vedas that he's sort of culled out of that work in order to develop the other things. But Savitri, it seems, because Savitri is also grounded in the Vedas, but in a way I think maybe, and this is just a maybe speculation on my part, but it's like the Vedas almost aren't complete in some sense. And Savitri is the completion of the Vedas, of the work of the Vedas. It's like there's an extra story that's not, because the Vedas are all about the gods and the relationships between the gods. The humans are present there, but it's the story of the relationship between the gods and the humans. Savitri is something a bit different. It's about this process of getting down into the nitty-gritty of the actual physical life and working yourself back up through it, right? That's what Savitri does, that the Secret of the Veda does not do. It describes it, but it doesn't do it, not in the way that Savitri does. So it's kind of a working through of something that I think Aurobindo felt was needed to be said in a way that wasn't said before, right? And obviously it's such a monumental work that as you go in through it and through it, you get to do the same kind of work as Aurobindo was doing with the writing and the giving expression to this. Anyway, that's my kind of reading of it after.
I think that's why they had to come. I love what you just said, because I believe that is why they had to come, and they are referred to as the avatars for our time. So what they brought was not available in the time of the Vedas. That yes. The consciousness had not really come down. It was seen, but they are embodying that and offering that possibility to us, opening that possibility to humanity.
Aurobindo said of this writing of Savitri, I mean, when he was writing it, he wasn't really intending it as something to publish. He said he was writing it to discover what of a spiritual practice or a spiritual development could happen through the writing of poetry. And so I think the statements that he made are an affirmation of what you were saying, Jeffrey. It's like he was doing in the poetry, he was using the poetry to as a means in his own sadhana of the earth, for the earth. So there was something incomplete. Otherwise, he said, you know, if everything has already been done, why am I spending all this time in labor and agony on this? And I think that once a poet gives a work, and usually a poet's role is to give what comes to him to his readers or to the people, then the purpose of that is for everyone to say, okay, this is mine. When I read it, it's me. It's in the way when Sri Aurobindo wrote it, it's him. And when we read it, when we take it on, the opportunity that we're being offered is to be that.
And what we said earlier about the voices speaking through from beyond, I was really mindful of the idea that you get that through writing poetry, right? When you write poetry, when it works at its best, you don't feel it's you writing. You feel it's something else that's coming through you, you know? So it's very related to this.
I remember something that Sri Aurobindo talked to Mother about wanting to embark on this. And he described it like embarking on the ocean without rudders, like not knowing where it would take him. That he kind of leapt into the unknown when he started this endeavor. He didn't understand it himself, what was gonna come. I like how you described that, John Robert, that it was through it that he did his work.
Did he ever read this out loud? Like in community or?
Did he ever read it in community?
Yes.
No, he was still working on it when he left. When he left his body, so it wasn't complete. In fact, Narodbaran, who was his scribe, because Sri Aurobindo's eyes went bad, he did lots and lots of writing at night. And anyway, Sri Aurobindo said to Narodbaran, "What's left to do?" And Narodbaran said, "Well, there's the canto on death." Because the canto of the death of Satyavan, when we read it, you'll see it's unlike that. It's like some of the early drafts of Savitri. It doesn't have the, it hasn't been, he didn't go back and revise it. And Sri Aurobindo said to him something like, "Oh, that's okay, we'll take care of that later." And he never got back to it. And of course, there's a lot of speculation about why, but he would recite it out loud to Narodbaran, who would write it down, especially after he couldn't write, he couldn't see what he was writing. And so Narodbaran would read to him, okay, this is the section that you wanted to work on, and would read to him what's down that so far. And then Sri Aurobindo would just start
pouring down.
Yeah. Just start coming down in a smooth, rhythmic flow, as Narodbaran described it.
Mother read a few of the sections.
Mm-hmm.
So there are recordings of Mother reading. Which is, of course, very powerful.
No, it's very interesting because, you know, to bring the work to a state of completion or near completion, and to inhabit it at the level of voice and at the level of embodiment, as one is writing it, and and to have it, like, and one has a sense of the inner need, let's say, where it needs to go, how it needs to be filled out, but not necessarily the larger meaning, because you're inside of it. You don't have the outside perspective, and what is being given, what's being offered by the poet, as in a way a byproduct of their spiritual process. Like, there's something that's happening on the inside that is prior to, and it's within, it's under, like, the language, under the words. But then there's the giving of words, or the and yet they're not totally separate either. Like, as the language comes, it also shapes the process and the experience, and in a way, like, makes it available. Like, the language makes it available to us. If we didn't have savitri, we could only speculate about Sri Aurobindo's yoga. This gives us a kind of vivid, a vivid sense, you know, a vivid, like, perceptual, like, experience, poetic experience of what that yoga entailed, and the draw, not just the technicality of it or the philosophy of it, but, like, the whole lived experience of it. And, you know, through the symbol, as you say, that we can relate to, because, you know, who can't relate to a love story, right? And, you know, at the archetypal level, like, the death of a beloved, and then the transcendence of that, the overcoming of that is, and that's as all the stories go, right? Right? Like, there's Orpheus here, and there's, I just watched a film, which is an adaptation of a book by Ken Wilber, called Grace and Grit. It was his most personal book, and it's one of the ones that attracted me to him, because it's also a story of love and loss, and of the overcoming of death. In this case, it was his wife. They had met and got married, and 10 days later she was diagnosed with cancer. And so the story is the whole process of her attempting to, you know, trying to heal and trying to come to terms with her death, and him with her death. And then in the book, he weaves their stories together. He uses her words from her journals, and interleaves those with his own narrative and his own, like, philosophical commentary. And it's a lot of ways a kind of the most embodied book of his. A lot of his other books are really theoretical, and, you know, he brings in a human element, but it's not always the priority. And here, obviously, savitri, it's all that, and it's a sustained endeavor. Like, this is a decades-long process, which is really daunting if you think about, like, yeah, taking on something that's going to take you until the end of your life, and it being, like, the receptacle, the carrier of, you know, of everything you can possibly learn, you know, about and bring forth about the path, about the spiritual path, and about not just for yourself and your particular relationship, but for humanity and for our sojourn upon the earth and in the stars. So I thank you for your insight and what you've been able to share from your personal experience and learning and your knowledge of history of this.
If you guys still have a little bit of time, I have here a few paragraphs that I would that really talk about all of this from Joris van Vrekem's book. That'd be okay?
Mm-hmm.
I wrote savitri as a means of ascension, wrote Sri Aurobindo in one of his many letters on his epic to Katie Setna, the very first person to receive and read a few lines of it. I began with it on a certain mental level. Each time I could reach a higher level, I rewrote from that level. In fact, savitri has not been regarded by me as a poem to be written and finished, but as a field of experimentation to see how far poetry could be written from one's own yogic consciousness and how that could be made creative. I wonder how he could go on dictating lines of poetry in this way, writes Niort Baran, as if a tap had been turned on and the water flowed. Not in a jet, of course, but slowly, very slowly indeed. Passages sometimes had to be reread in order to get the link or sequence. But when the turn came of the Book of Yoga and the Book of Everlasting Day, line after line began to flow from his lips like a smooth and gentle stream. To Mona Sarkar, a young sadhak at the time, the mother gave a revealing inside view on savitri. All this is his own experience. And what is most surprising is that it is my own experience also. It is my sadhana which he has worked out. Each object, each event, each realization, all the descriptions, even the colors are exactly what I saw, and the words and phrases are also exactly what I heard. I read savitri many times afterwards, but earlier, when he was writing, he used to read it to me. Every morning, I used to listen to him reading savitri. During the night, he would write and in the morning read it to me. And I observed something curious, that day after day, the experience he read out to me in the morning were those I had had the previous night. Word for word, all the descriptions, the colors, the pictures I had seen, the words I had heard, all, I heard it all, put by him into poetry, into miraculous poetry. And it was not just one day by chance, but for days and days together. And every time I used to compare what he said with my previous experiences, and they were always the same. I repeat, it was not what I had told him, that I had told him my experiences, that he had noted them down afterwards. No, he knew already what I had seen. It is my experiences he has presented at length, and they were his experiences also. It is moreover the picture of our joint adventure into the unknown, or rather into the supermind.
So he did read aloud, if informally.
To her.
Yes. Yeah.
It's kind of lovely to imagine that first thing in the morning she would have time with him. Because her life was very, very, very full, you know, taking care of everybody and everything, that they had time together.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm trying to find the passage we read where he talks about the mantric quality of what was being said, but I'm not finding it. I don't think I need to make that connection any further necessarily. I think we talked a little bit about that. It's curious though that he didn't become totally fluid with it until the Book of Love and the latter book. So there was some like development of the capacity, even, or of the openness, or of the fluidity with which the poetry would come through. And there were maybe in earlier phases more of a traditional like writing first draft and revising process, you know, before the form would be settled, before the canto would be complete.
What he just described is that they would reread it back to him, and he would have ascended to a higher consciousness by that time, and it would rewrite the previous. So he kept rewriting every time he ascended higher in his consciousness. He would rewrite what he had written before.
But then it seems like latter and toward the end, maybe there was less of that, and
yeah.
It was more like
right. First,
just right. what came through, and there was less revision.
Yeah.
And then maybe in some places that you can feel that, like the Book of Death, right? Where he knew he needed to return to it, but hadn't like finished maybe evolving or developing to the point where he could say something definitive, or where
he hadn't gone through death.
He hadn't died yet.
He didn't have the experience, so he didn't write about it.
That's interesting. I'll be interested to see how it fits in, then how it works.
Yeah.
And he didn't write it all sequentially either. I mean, no. he would go back and rework parts that were in the middle, like the Book of Fate, The Way of Fate and the Problem of Pain. That's a really long canto that's ahead of us. And he went back towards the end of his life and added lots of pages to that. So it wasn't like starting at the beginning and coming to the end. It was a lot more organic than that.
So are we good for a meditation, or we don't want to finish a short circuit the discussion if there's still more, but.
Yeah, thanks for bringing up all those questions, Marco. That's really, I mean, it's wonderful to kind of review and ruminate and go deeper.
Thank you guys for mm-hmm. game to go deeper into what we're doing here and what's really going on in this text and in our reading. I'm glad to be able to do it, and it always gives me a kind of boost, you know, for.
Yeah.
It's an immersion, right? It's an immersion, and we get to do that together. It's just wonderful.
Indeed.
An immersion and an immersion, maybe. Too.
Yeah.
Thank you, everybody. Joy reading with you and being with you.
Wonderful.
Thank you, thank you. Indeed. Be well, Marco. Be well, recover.
I'm on the mend.
Yeah.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everyone.